everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we're going to be talking all about sex education and things that we wish we were taught in sex ed back in, I think fifth grade was when I had my first sex ed class. And kind of just comparing that to what I know now about sex education. And there's just a lot of things that I honestly didn't even learn until my 20s. And while, you know, sex ed has to be made age appropriate, and that's totally understandable, there's just still a lot of things that we as women mostly are not taught about our bodies, about how our bodies function, that lead us to make decisions later on that end up negatively impacting our health. And if we maybe were taught that at a younger age, it could have been prevented. So,
yeah, I feel like it's not only just sex education, like the sex aspect of things. It is also like women's reproductive education that we are literally not taught at all. And this is something that we went over in like our birth control episodes, because that's like a big part of this episode. We'll be talking about some of the things that sex education didn't teach us about, like birth control, our periods, whatnot as women. And I feel like this is just such a large issue that you don't really realize until you're our age and you're wanting to go off birth control, or you're curious about like other methods of contraception. So we thought that this episode would be helpful to people because I feel like there are just so many myths out there and things we didn't learn. So let's dive into it. The first thing, this like literally blew both of Tatum and I's minds when we figured this out. And I feel like every single person I talk with about birth control, I reiterate this too, because one, and I think you can agree to this, I feel like sex education scares us about sex, makes us think that any second you can get pregnant, you look at a boy, you can get pregnant, and it doesn't empower us. It just makes us feel literally scared shitless that you can get pregnant at any moment. So a really, really, really interesting and cool piece of knowledge to know is that you can only get pregnant 5 to 6 days out of your cycle, and Tatum will explain more about that.
Yeah, really quickly, I totally agree with the whole like scare approach. I think that's definitely the way I learned it as well, not just from sex ed that I learned in school, but also from my parents. Like, I feel like my parents were like, abstinence is the only way. But I also just wanted to say, like, why do we make it out to be this like huge, absolutely like life-ending thing if you were to get pregnant? Like, I understand, like, if you're, you know, maybe 15, 16 years old, that's obviously not ideal, but like it also is not the end of your life. Like, I don't know, it's just kind of like this weird like stigma around getting pregnant, and I understand while it's not preferred, like it's also, it doesn't mean that your life is over, you know?
Yeah, I feel like they scare you rather than explaining how much of a responsibility it is to have a child. I feel like that is what is the part that we need to be educated on. Children are freaking expensive, your life changes, we all know this. But I feel like that's the part that is important rather than actually getting pregnant, because it happens and no, you're not going to die from it, and they make it seem like it's literally a disease.
For sure. So, okay, let's talk about how there really are only 5 to 6 days out of your cycle where you are fertile, meaning that you could possibly get pregnant. And this is for a normal cycle. So I want to go ahead and preface that with saying, like, this is only if your cycles are normal, because if they're
like
not,
you're not on birth control,
right? Yeah. 5 to 6 days, where that number comes from basically. So let's say your cycle is 28 days long. That's like a usual normal cycle. And let's say you ovulate exactly halfway through on day 14 of your cycle. The fertile window is 5 to 6 days is the whole window. And that's, basically 5 days before you ovulate. And that number five comes from the fact that sperm can live inside you for up to 5 days. 5 days before, 5 days before you ovulate, you are fertile. So let's say you have sex exactly 5 days before you ovulate, you could potentially get pregnant, because if that sperm lives inside you for 5 days and then you ovulate on day five, there could potentially be an egg that's fertilized. And then the sixth day is because the egg that you release is good for 24 hours. So that's another thing that I feel like a lot of women don't know, is that when you ovulate, you only, first of all, release one egg. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're just releasing a bunch of, like, thousands of eggs at one time. Like, you're only releasing one.
What about if you're having twins? Oh, it's the sperm?
No, I think that's not relevant. That would be, like, if you happen release two and they both get fertilized, okay, that's when you would continue. Have twins. And the egg is good for 24 hours, so that adds sixth day to it. So your fertile window is basically 5 days before you ovulate and then 1 day after ovulation. So that is kind of like when you could get pregnant. Obviously, there are, you know, like one-off rare occurrences where it could happen outside of this window, but like that's like a very extremely rare situation.
So our whole point of telling you that is just to like destigmatize that you can get pregnant every single day. Again, this is only if you are not on hormonal birth control, you are having a normal, natural hormonal cycle, which again, a lot of women, first of all, aren't having because we've been on birth control for years, our hormones are messed up. Anywho, but like when people are trying to get pregnant, this is a lot of the times when they get educated on this, because obviously you have to be very strategic on when you have sex. And I think that a lot of the times when people get educated on this is when they're actually trying to get pregnant, because you have to try to get pregnant. Like, yes, there's some fertile freaking myrtles in this world who just can get pregnant right away. But a lot of women, it takes them multiple months, them trying very hard and being very strategic with their bodies to actually get pregnant, especially we're experiencing a huge fertility issue now because of hormonal birth control, stress, hormonal imbalances, all the things. So just know that it's actually way harder to get pregnant than you think. And if you're experiencing a normal cycle, you've been off of birth control, your hormones are balanced, there are only 5 to 6 days out of the month that it's literally even possible for you to get pregnant. So that is number one.
Number two, hormonal. Hormonal birth control is not your only option. I feel like in sex ed, I was taught that there were other options besides hormonal birth control, but the idea was very much put in my head that those options weren't as good. For example, like condoms. Like I remember learning about condoms and like the whole thing was like, well, they could possibly break though. So like that might not be your safest option. And again, I feel like the main thing I was taught in sex ed was like really the only way to prevent getting pregnant is to not have sex at all, which I mean, yeah, technically that is true, but I was definitely taught that the non-hormonal birth control options are just not as reliable, and that the hormonal options are the ones that are like 99% effective, and like that's as close as you're going to be able to get, so like that's what you should do. And we have a whole episode on birth control, coming off birth control, and kind of what some of the other options are, but fertility awareness method is what Liv and I both use, and that is a non-hormonal birth control option where you basically track your cycles, you track your periods, you track your temperature, so you take your temperature every single morning, and that kind of shows you where your hormone levels are at, when you might possibly be ovulating, when's your fertile window, so you can actually tell a lot about when you might be fertile just based on your basal body temperature when you wake up in the morning, and other symptoms. Like for example, you'll log like your cervical mucus quality, what it looks like, you'll log when you get your period, when your period ends. So we use a certain app that does all of this for us, but it basically keeps track of all these things and then kind of like gives you a pretty close estimated window of when you might either want to try to get pregnant or avoid.
Yeah, I think Tatum and I are both proponents of the fertility awareness method. One, because it's the only one that doesn't mess with your body in some way. We've talked so many times, and you can listen to our episodes about how birth control affects the body. Even the copper IUD, that's not hormonal, but it's an overload of copper in your body, which that can also cause issues. And so this is like the only non-invasive kind of way to not pump your body full of chemicals or copper or things that your body doesn't need. And the other like very big value to the fertility awareness method, and I just think of like when we have kids, hopefully girls, and they grow up and like are starting to be in a phase where they might want to look into birth control, it is so important, and we have become so disconnected with our bodies as women. We don't know like what periods mean, what the blood color of our period could mean, if we're having cramps, what that could mean. Like we just don't know anything about our bodies. I didn't know shit about shit in my body. And the fertility awareness method forces you to become more in tune with your body because you're having to track your temperature every morning. You're having to like pay attention to your period and the way you feel and whatnot. And that is just something that is so helpful in your overall health. Your period is like, they call it like the vital sign. Like, it tells you so much about your overall health. And so it's just a good method to really understand your body and become more in tune and more of like an advocate for your own health.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't know like what any of the signs my body was telling me meant at all until I started tracking my cycles. And now I have gotten to a point where like, if I like don't take my temperature for a couple days or whatever, I still can pretty much tell what part of my cycle I'm in just by how I feel, and like cervical mucus and all that type of stuff. Just being educated on those types of things makes me feel so empowered in my decisions and not be so like anxious about the fact that like I could possibly have gotten pregnant, because I just like know my body so well now that it's like, oh, I know I'm good, like I'm fine, and I just don't even worry about it anymore. So it also just relieves a lot of that like mental stress if you are trying to avoid getting pregnant.
Yeah. Next one, and this one like actually gets me a little bit fired up and annoyed, because I think some people think that this is so normal. Missing and delayed periods and contraception that makes you have missing and delayed periods isn't normal. I cannot emphasize this enough. It is so important for our bodies as women to be having a period and to be bleeding every single month. When, and we talk about this so much in the birth control episode, when we suppress our periods, we suppress our hormonal function, and our hormonal function is like suppressing your pee and poop. Like, you don't do that. So why are we suppressing our hormones? Again, understand the fact that people don't want to get pregnant. It is necessary to have education around that and have types of birth control. But if you are on a birth control, the shot, something that makes you not have your period for a year for multiple months, like, I'm getting anxiety about that, just thinking about that. And I used to be on some that was like, oh, you'll only have it every 3 months. And I'm like, yes, I don't have to have my period. I don't have to bleed for a few months. And while, yes, that is really convenient, because no, it's not the most convenient thing in the world to have a week out of the month where you're bleeding and feeling different. It is so not normal for your body. And so I really, really, really want to stop normalizing like, oh yeah, my birth control is going to make me not have period for a month. That is actually really, really harmful to your hormones. And like I mentioned, we're having a big fertility problem with women in our generation. It is partly because we are on these pills and contraceptives that make it so we don't have periods. So it's very important to have a normal cycle, and it is not normal for us to be suppressing our periods for months or years on end.
Yeah, I was on the pill for a few years, and I always got my period, you know, withdrawal bleed. Yeah, withdrawal. Yeah, not even a real period, but a withdrawal bleed when I was on the pill. And it was like so much, it was like way less blood than a normal period, way less painful, and it kind of like got like rid of all the things that I thought were like so bad about a period. But what I wasn't realizing is that the things I was having before I went on birth control weren't normal either, and I was already having probably hormonal imbalances, and then I went on the pill, which probably made it worse. And now that I'm off the pill, I'm still dealing with sometimes painful periods and like trying to kind of get back into balance in that way. So yeah, it's also, I want to say, like, hormonal birth control is not going to be a solution if you are already missing and having delayed periods. Going on the pill or whatever other type of hormonal birth control is also not going to solve that problem.
And I think that they present it as like hormonal birth control like regulates your hormones in your periods because you're putting synthetic hormones into your body. And while I guess maybe in some ways that could be true because you're getting the same hormones pumped into you every month, those aren't your hormones. Those are synthetic hormones. We've talked about this a lot. And so missing your periods is not normal. And like Tatum said, how that a lot of people go on the pill to fix their symptoms, that brings us perfectly into our next point. It's common but not normal to have cramps, PMS, acne, etc. with periods. This is also something that we have normalized, like in television, in every single thing. It's like, are you on your period because someone's like being bitchy or moody? Again, not normal. When your cycles are regulated, your hormones are regulated, you're supporting your body, you don't experience any of those things. Like, maybe I get a little bit of cramp, as in my body saying like, okay, you're about to bleed, but I don't get PMS, like maybe a little bit of cravings, like, okay, some of those things are just like at a low level normal, but like having such bad cramps that you have to skip school or skip class, feeling nauseous, having a bunch of breakouts when you are on your period, all of those things are normal because we are in an epidemic of so much hormonal imbalance, rather than that's just what comes with having periods.
Okay, the next one is that women have monthly cycles while men do not. So the male hormone cycle is only 24 hours. They have the highest testosterone in the morning and the lowest in the evening. So that's something else that we did not learn, is how big of a difference male hormones are from women's, and like the cycles surrounding those. And it actually explains just like so much about how women like just need more time to like process things, regulate their emotions, work through their feelings, that kind of thing, because we are basically experiencing the valleys and peaks of our hormones in a 28-day period compared to 24 hours. So it's like, I guess however much that would be, like 20, almost 28 times slower than what men are experiencing. So to kind of explain like what our hormonal cycle looks like and how that might impact like our energy levels, during our follicular phase, which is the half of your cycle before ovulation, that's when estrogen starts gradually rising. So you might notice in the first half of your cycle, each day you kind of start to gain like a little bit more energy, feeling a little bit more on like in a better mood, all the way up until ovulation, which is when estrogen peaks. Usually that's when women are feeling the most energized, good mood during this time. And then post-ovulation, estrogen starts to drop a little while progesterone starts to rise. And this can actually have like a depressant effect, which is sometimes why women begin to feel a little bit more sluggish as their period starts to approach. So this whole process of our hormones, kind of these like little waves, is normal. But when your hormones are imbalanced, these shifts in hormone production might feel a lot bigger or more extreme to you, resulting in more moodiness or PMS compared to like the usual small dip. So like having different energy levels throughout your menstrual cycle is totally normal, but it shouldn't be like this huge roller coaster where you're like feeling like you're going up and down every single day and like all over the place.
And something that I think is a really good resource for people, and we've been thinking about doing an episode on this for like, I swear, 7 years, and we just haven't done it yet, is for especially women, kind of how to live by your cycle. Like Tatum said, we are on a 28-day cycle, so we need different nourishment, different exercises, and different rest during different times of this cycle. And males, they're on 24 hours, so they're just kind of go mode every single day. And something that's super interesting about this book, did I say the book? In the Flow is what it's called. Is that like our whole work system has been basically made for males. We go from 8 to 5, 9 to 5 every single day, do the same thing, the same output is expected of us. But if we could make it a woman's world, which it already is, by the way, we would have like some weeks where we would be working so hard. We have all this energy. We're like going ham. And then we would have other weeks where maybe we're taking half days. We're resting. We have long weekends. And that is how like our bodies as women best work. So if you are an entrepreneur, if you are a like work for yourself type person, I don't do this, but it would actually be a good idea for me to do, is to kind of like plan your work schedule a little bit with your cycle. When you have those times that's more energy, you can do much more. You can do more intense workouts. You can be eating differently. And then when you're in those times when you're in like your period or leading up to your period, your body needs more rest, and to like carve out during your month that type of rest and maybe a little bit of a different workflow. Again, we'll probably do an episode on this that dives deep into like workouts, foods, what your body needs during each part of your cycle. But I think it's just something interesting to note. Like even if you have a partner or you're with somebody, like they're on a completely different hormonal schedule than you, and even though your lives are synced, they might need something very differently than you need in that moment. And that is just the beauty of being a woman.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's like female tech startups that work like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and they do everything based on like the, that sounds amazing. Okay, so the next one is that quality of feminine products that you use matters. I really never really was taught this one.
I was on my Tampax fruity vibe.
Fragranced Tampax, yeah. And something interesting that I learned today is that about 85% of women use tampons, which I think is interesting that, like, that's the most normalized feminine product.
Like, I feel like that does the job the best.
I get it. It does do the job the best, but I also feel like we need to give women the other options and, like, put them on an even playing field and let them decide which one works the best for them instead of just automatically being like, you should use tampons. I don't know. I just feel like if we're gonna promote,
do you feel like people don't talk about, like, pads and whatnot?
I think when I first got my period, my parents suggested I use pads first.
Same.
I assume that's just because, like, as a young girl, like, you're probably not comfortable putting anything up there and you don't know how. But I never, ever, ever, ever knew what a menstrual cup was until I was, like, 20-something.
Yeah, we still both don't use menstrual cups, right?
No, I don't use menstrual cups now, but I just think that... But that's because I don't think that they would work for me. I think tampons do work best for me, but I'm just saying I think that they should all be presented as equal options, and you can try them all and see what works best for you. If you want to use pads, like, you should be able to use pads. I think that's also a thing, is, like, people are like, oh, well, once you're past a certain age, like, you shouldn't be using those anymore. Like, no, you can use whatever the hell you want. Okay. Anyways, on to tampons are the ones that get, I guess, the most hate, because that's literally something that you're putting up inside you in one of the most absorbent parts of your body. Yeah. So toxins in tampons come from a couple different places. Tampons that are not 100% cotton usually means that rayon is present. Rayon is a material that is known to contain carbon disulfide, which is a reproductive toxin. Parabens and phthalates are also commonly present in tampons and pads, and they're usually either used as a preservative or, like, part of a fragrance. You also don't need fragranced feminine products. You don't.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, it's not... I think that's another thing that we teach women, is that they have to be, like, clean and smelling amazing all the time.
I just want to say really quickly, this isn't on our topic, but if you're still using Vagisil, please throw that in the garbage right now. If you're using a feminine wash that has fragrance, girl, it's just, it's so many chemicals to, like Tatum said, the most absorbable part of your body, and you should be clean, fruity, and great on your own if your body is running a normal hormonal cycle.
And if you're eating well, hydrating, and doing all the other things, yeah, your body will take care of all of that for you. Okay, moving on. So phthalates and parabens are known hormone disruptors. Lots of tampons and pads also have antibacterial chemicals in them, which throws off our vaginal flora and sometimes causes infections and discomfort. I can remember when I accidentally one time bought a box of fragrant tampons and my vagina completely freaked out.
Like, I got a yeast infection from doing
that. Same. Got a yeast infection. Everything was thrown off for, like, a week. It was not fun. Yeah. So when your body reacts that way, it's just a sign that, like, this product is not serving you. Another big thing is pesticides. Enter trolls in the chat. Cotton is one of the most common genetically modified organisms. Most cotton these days is a GMO and is sprayed with glyphosate. So this has been proven in scientific studies where they have tested tampons and found glyphosate in them. Again, that is not something that you want to be putting in one of the most absorbent parts of your body. Don't want to put it in your body regardless, but especially with tampons. So what to buy? What should you be looking for on a package of tampons, pads? 100% organic cotton is the first thing. No fragrance, and also chlorine-free. You want them to be unbleached. That's just, I feel like, self-explanatory. You probably don't want chlorine and bleach in your vag. Honeypot and Rail.
Yeah, I use everything. I use all of Rail's feminine stuff.
Yeah, those are two brands that we really trust. The other thing I want to say is, again, don't be afraid to use other methods or try them out, like menstrual cups, if that's comfortable to you. Not sure about the silicone that menstrual cups are made of. We don't know a whole lot about silicone, but
silicone's up for debate because there's so many things. Like, think of the little natural iPads we use under our eyes. Those are silicone. Medical grade silicone. I read about this. You need to make sure it's medical grade. And what's the menstrual cup that everybody uses? Something girl? You know, it's the one that's like literally everywhere. We'll link.
Yeah, we can link it. And then also the like reusable, washable period underwear. That's something that I've actually been interested in trying for bedtime. Because you're not supposed to sleep in a tampon for that long. But it's like reusable, washable period underwear that you can wear to sleep instead of having to wear a tampon. Again, if any of these things are uncomfortable to you, you don't have to do them. Just throwing it out there that like these are all things that are, you know, totally options. Fine and options. And if you want to try them out and they work well for you, don't be like, you know, intimidated by them or feel shameful for using them just because tampons are the most normalized. So yeah, see what works for you, but that is what you need to be looking for in your feminine products. Okay, the last one, we touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but sex is not taboo, nor should it scare you. I think it's also really interesting that we teach children that sex is only for reproduction. I understand that like we don't need to be teaching children that like that sex can be sometimes for pleasure and fun because we don't want to give them that idea so young.
I was just going to say, this makes me think of how people teach us about alcohol. We have such a big alcohol drive, like me, crazy little alcohol drinker in high school, way underage, because it was like, you can't drink alcohol till you're 21. Like, it's so bad if you do it, blah, 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 blah. Same thing as sex. People go crazy, don't educate themselves, and like hold it away from their parents and don't tell people because we make it seem like this such taboo thing. So then, of course, when you let open the floodgates and kids are able to kind of make their own decision, find their own things, of course they're going to go crazy. I think that, yes, obviously, there are big responsibilities that come with sex. You can get pregnant, which is a huge freaking responsibility. But if we more normalize talking to our children about like, oh, yeah, there's a big responsibility that comes with it. But the only purpose, there's so many other purposes that people have sex. There's so many things out there. And so, yes, it doesn't need to be taboo. And if we make it and alcohol and drugs and all of these taboo things more of a normal conversation, we won't have little 14, 15-year-olds going freaking ham on all of these things because it'll just be a part of our normal life like everything else is.
I do remember the very first time that my parents told me that sex is not just for reproduction and that it can be for pleasure. I wanted to throw up. I was so humiliated. But I do think that it's an important conversation to be having with not like children in fifth grade, but like teenagers.
It's going to happen whether they want it to or not, right, at a certain age.
Yeah, it's a conversation that needs to be had. It's something that like it's natural to want to explore your sexuality even at a very young age. That's part of human nature and how we are designed. And so I think that sex education should kind of embrace that a little bit and obviously do it in a way that is not, you know, encouraging them to go have sex for pleasure. But you know what I mean? Just like opening up the conversation that sexuality is also important and exploring that is also important. And with that, I wish sex ed taught us how to have hard conversations with people about not wanting to have sex, setting boundaries, and communicating your preferences or your needs. I was so uncomfortable when I first started having sex, like setting boundaries and like saying I didn't want to do something or asking somebody to use a condom. Like that was just like so uncomfortable to me because in sex ed, we like weren't taught how to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. We were taught like you need to use protection, but not necessarily like how to ask somebody to use protection and how to voice your needs on that topic. And it just became so uncomfortable for me that I ended up just not doing it a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. And the other part, I feel like this is more around the sex scare. And I think I saw that you had this on the notes, is that like the whole conversation of STDs and like some of the unfortunate things that can come with having sex from people who are also having sex with other people and whatnot, having conversations around asking that, the testing. Mm-hmm. I was like, I could never get one of those. But I did not know like where you would go to find those resources, how you would test for those things, signs and symptoms you might have them. And so I think that side is also like, yes, we do need to educate about the responsibility and the maybe not so great things that come from having sex.
And the stigma that like if you get an STD, it means you're scandalous or like those are the only types of people who get STDs. Mm-hmm. I think that's another big misconception that we're taught in sex ed. And so then when it does happen to you and you only had sex with one or two people and you feel so guilty about it, it's like that mental aspect of it too is just like not fair, and we shouldn't have that idea put in our heads because when it does happen, then we're afraid to address it, we're afraid to have a conversation with somebody, and it just makes it so that people just don't people just don't bring it up. They're like, oh, I'll just go get tested. I'll go get treated myself. Not going to tell the other person, too scared. And then obviously that person spreads it to somebody else. And it's just like this vicious cycle of everyone feeling shameful about it. And it just does not need to be that way.
Yeah. And that brings me to my last point in this episode, is that I think it's very underlying in sex education, but they like make this concept in our minds that sex and your sex status and your sexual activity is tied to your self-worth. And that if you're like a good, responsible girl or boy, you will not have sex until you're blah, 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 18. You will always wear a condom. You will not get pregnant till you're 26. And then if you're like a rebel, ding dong, worthless little girl, you will be trying all these things and be experimenting and being a crazy cuckoo. And I hope that we all know, everybody who's probably older than high school listening to this episode, knows that your sex status is not tied to your self-worth literally at all. I know amazing people who are not sexually active at all, and I know amazing people who are very sexually active, and it doesn't make a difference. Again, this is just breaking down the stigma of sex, but I think that that is something that I have very much like held the thought in my mind that like if you're somebody who has sex with multiple people, or if you're somebody who had sex at a young age or blah blah blah, like something's wrong with you, like you must not like care about yourself that much. And actually it could mean you really care about yourself, you really care about your pleasure, you really care about your connection with people. So let's shut that one up. And I think, do you have anything to add to end off this? This is Tatum and I's sex education. We're giving you guys sex education that we wish we would have had.
No, I think that's it. I think it's really important to think about also how you're going to educate your children on this topic. Just something to think about. I mean, I know there's people who listen to this podcast who are like not thinking about having kids anytime soon, but it's something that I think about very often, how I will educate my kids on this. And once you are in a position where you can actually advocate for better sex education practices, if you have a child who's enrolled in school, like look into what they're teaching them. I feel like also like, it's sometimes uncomfortable for parents. They're like, oh, we'll just let the school do it. We'll just let them handle it. Yeah. And I want to make sure that I am just so open and transparent with my child about things like this, because, yeah, just seeing how the lack of information impacted my choices, not anything against my parents at all, because my parents were very open. But we definitely need some change in that area of education as a whole, as a system. Okay, well, I hope you guys had fun with that episode and learned something today. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions about anything we said, any, you know, things you want us to elaborate on, personal experiences, and we'll see you guys next week for another episode.